Good afternoon and welcome. This is Saturday with Katie Hannan. Philip Boucher-Hayes in for Katie on the programme today. What does and should Irish neutrality mean in an age when a bloodied war criminal seeks to impose his will on Europe? Is the freedom to sack 800 P&O staff with little or no apparent consequence what Brexit was always about? And are we in a position to protest it in any way if it would lead to further supply chain and cost of living increases? And you got a day off yesterday to commemorate the sacrifice of all in tackling COVID, but healthcare workers are still waiting for their €1,000 payment. We will ask, have gesture politics trumped substance? Our panel this afternoon, Sinn Féin TD Rose Conway-Walsh, elected for the first time in 2020 in Mayo. Fianna Fáil Dublin MEP Barry Andrews has been in Brussels for a similar amount of time. And People Before Profit TD Mick Barry has been serving the people of Cork North Central in the Dáil since 2016. Good afternoon to all of you. Thank you very much for joining us today. The time for talk is now, said Ukrainian President Zelensky in another video message last night, pressing what they feel is their advantage in stalling the Russian advance. But yesterday in Moscow, President Putin told a large stadium audience, "My work is not finished." And that work continued overnight in the city of Mariupol, where there is now fighting in the city centre. Earlier this week, Russian bombers brought Putin's war to Lviv, just 80 kilometres away from Poland and the borders of the European Union. The very real prospect of the conflict spilling over into the EU has concentrated minds in Europe's capitals. How to contain it, what signals to send to Putin, how to respond if it happens. Here it has renewed discussion about what, if anything, our traditional neutrality means any longer. So to begin this afternoon, folks, the same question, please, for everybody on the panel. Start with you, Barry Andrews. Is Irish neutrality non-negotiable, or is it something that should be redefined for each new conflict?
I think once the assumptions that underpin our policy change as they have so fundamentally since the 24th of February, then we have to review and analyse where we are. There are a couple of elements to it that I think that are very clearly up for grabs, particularly around the triple lock, where we are. We have granted a veto to the UN Security Council for any deployment of troops. I think the landing ground here might be that the lock that the UN has over such decisions should instead be the UN or the European Union in order to provide the safeguard that Irish citizens clearly want to have, but at the same time allow for the flexibility which is denied when Russia and China have a veto over Irish policy. There are other elements of our cooperation with the European Union which I think we could do more of. For example, under PESCO, which is Permanent Structured Cooperation, we all voted for that in the Lisbon Treaty, and also in common security and defence policy. We've had lots and lots of CSDP missions with the European Union over the last 20 or 30 years.
Common security and defence policy.
And we could do an awful lot more. The final question where we need to have a public debate is around the question of a common defence in the European Union, which is a question essentially is what happens if Ireland is attacked? Do we expect anybody to come to our aid? What happens if another EU member state is attacked, which is now an issue for the
Something
first time.
Something we have signed up to with the Lisbon Treaty.
We haven't. We have an opt out from it because we had a second Lisbon vote, as you know, and locked into that was a commitment not to submit to any decision.
The 27
we
members.
The European Union signed up for it, but Ireland is an opt out in that. So I think that's where the debate really is. And that's a really tricky debate. And that's why I think the Taoiseach is proposing this idea that we socialise this, we let people give their view. It's just too sensitive an issue to be imposing any decisions. And in any case, all of that is protected by constitutional provisions.
Rose, where are you coming from? Is it a fixed line in the sand, or given the events that are happening 2,000 kilometres to the east, is it something that has to be reviewed?
No, I think the priority has to be to stop the war now. And I think any other conversation, there isn't room for any other conversation at this time. And to be introducing it, I think, is quite reckless. I think Ireland has a very significant role to play as part of the EU Security Council as the only non-NATO member on that. Neutrality isn't about isolationism or sitting idly by as a disinterested observer. It's about active engagement. in a global community and the relentless pursuit of global justice. And I think we have a key role to play, but not around, I think, eroding our neutrality at this particular time is reckless, and I certainly wouldn't be going down that route.
Mick Barry, who's joining us remotely from Cork, Rose is saying reckless to review. Barry is saying parts of it should be up for review. Where are you?
Where I am is to say that this war must be stopped. The Russian troops must be withdrawn lock, stock and barrel from Ukraine. And I think that there are agendas pre-existing that are being pushed here in relation to neutrality. First of all, I would say that Ireland is not a genuinely neutral state. We saw that with the Iraq war, where Shannon Airport was made available effectively free gratis and for nothing for the US war drive there. And Shannon continues to be used. And I think that now there are powerful states in the European Union, such as Germany, which has decided to rearm and to triple its arms expenditure, and France, whose president, Monsieur Macron, is a longstanding supporter of a European army, who see the opportunity to push this agenda now. And I don't think that the Irish government should be going down that road, and I don't think the Irish people will agree to go down that road.
Same hypothetical question then, please, to all of you. Let us imagine, because it's not beyond the bounds of possibility at this stage, that if just one of Vladimir Putin's missiles was to creep 12 miles further to the west than they already have and lands inside Poland, in the EU, what then, Barry Andrews, should Ireland's response be?
Well, Ireland is prohibited from common defence, as you know, in our constitution. And we cannot deploy our troops overseas without the triple lock. And I didn't hear from either Rose or Mick as to whether they think Russia should continue to enjoy a veto over those decisions.
We have routinely deployed up to 11 Army Rangers overseas ignoring the triple lock.
12 is a threshold. That's why we were able to do that. But anything beyond that, we have to get a UN Security Council approval. Now, the world's changed on the 24th of February. And if your view of the world hasn't changed since the 24th of February, it's a willful blindness to this new reality. And it's not just, as Mick says, larger EU member states who are changing with these new circumstances. Denmark is proposing to have a referendum in September on the CSDP. Both Finland and Sweden are reviewing their membership of NATO, something I wouldn't support for Ireland whatsoever.
What should we do here? Because the logic of what you're saying is that we would, at this point in time, be bound by Vladimir Putin's veto at the Security Council. We wouldn't be able to take any action.
I think Ireland has to have this debate. I think it's a very, very sensitive issue in Ireland. And when major...
We know there needs to be a debate. What would you do is my answer. In response to an EU nation being attacked.
I'm telling you that, well, I think one of the things that we can do and is absolutely within our remit and isn't against any constitutional taboos is the deployment of peacekeepers within the European Union. It's something that we could do and has been floated as an idea. I happened to visit the UNIFIL mission, the Irish battalion in South Lebanon only a few weeks ago, and they are tremendous. They have a huge tradition across peacekeeping around the world. I think our role as well in the UN Security Council is very time limited. There's only a short period of that left. And I think Ireland has clearly a role to play there in terms of trying to get this a resolution of the conflict as soon as possible. So we have some tracks that we can apply, but they're very limited. We don't certainly don't have military weapons that we can deploy within the European Union.
Mick Barry, the logic of your position is that we wouldn't do anything, that we would stand mutely by if a missile landed inside the EU.
Well, I'm looking at the situation over the last month, and I see two huge positives amid all of the horror, and it is a horror story. But within it, I do see two positives, and neither of them have to do with conventional military operations. What I'm referring to here is, on the one hand, the resistance of the ordinary working class people of Ukraine who have blocked railway lines, who've blown.
You're deflecting attention from my question, though, Mick Barry, and that is, what should Ireland do in the event of EU borders being breached by Russia?
What I'm doing, Philip, is I'm turning the question around on you, right? And you should allow me the chance to make the point, right? Which is that on the one hand, the resistance of the ordinary Ukrainian people, but also on the other hand, something which is not getting enough focus and commentary, the anti-war protests that are being organised by ordinary people in Russia. And, you know, I would make the point that when you had dictatorships in Eastern Europe back in the day, the Ceausescus and so on, it wasn't NATO tanks or military means that brought them to an end. It was people power. And I think that there has to be a discussion taking place about how there is assistance given to people power and to ordinary working people in their resistance in these countries.
Philip, the far left have spectacularly misread the intentions of Russia for not just the last 6 months, but for over a decade, going back to the annexation of Crimea. And I think what we have to understand here is under the UN Charter, not under anything to do with the European Union, but the UN Charter, Article 51, entitles any member state to defend itself. And it's not about ordinary Ukrainian workers. This is the Ukrainian government and its armed forces defending itself against a crime against peace. And that's what's happening here. And decisions have been taken at the European level to defend this, not just because it's a war crime, but because it's an assault on the values that the European Union stands for democracy. And it's an assault on the territorial integrity of the European Union. And we have to stand up for that. We are not neutral on this issue.
Can I suggest to you, Mick Barry, that there is an illogicality in your position, though, that on the one hand you say we should remain absolutely neutral, but on the other hand that we should give assistance and support to the anti-Putin forces within Russia?
Well, it's an interesting point that you raise there, Philip, because when it comes to a struggle of ordinary people against an autocrat or a dictatorial regime, of course, socialists are not neutral. We would have actively supported the struggle of black workers in South Africa against the apartheid regime, for example. And I think the Ukrainian people have a right to resist and an armed resistance against the invasion of their country.
But, so you do see the inconsistency in your position here then, Mick. Neutral when it suits us, but not all the time.
No, what I'm saying is that I do not support military alliances made up of powerful capitalist countries in Europe in relation to this. So, for example, let's look at the concrete example you gave. A missile goes 15 miles further than it did and it strays into Poland. And the conflict now is NATO, eyeball to eyeball with Russia, with nuclear weapons part of the equation there. Barry Andrews effectively is saying, pick a side. And what I'm saying is that in a situation such as that, the idea that NATO and the United States, on the one hand, are the good guys, and Russia with Putin, on the other hand, are the bad guys. Putin, of course, is a bad guy. He's an autocrat. And what he's done is absolutely horrific here. But if that's going to be an argument to get people to fall in behind United States, NATO, or the militarisation of Europe, you're not going to have support from socialists and a lot of ordinary people in this country too.
Rose Conway-Walsh, how would Sinn Féin respond to a missile landing inside the EU?
Well, I think that's just speculating. I think we need to do everything we possibly can to prevent that. And we know that the ending of the war will only come through diplomacy and through sanctions. So there's many more things we can do before that happens. And one of those things is the sanctions and the money, the 118 billion that's gone through the IFSC.
What's the difference? So I think what's the difference between sanctions and military support? Ultimately, is it not an expression of which side you're on?
No, there's a huge difference. And I think we see it that the Irish people value deeply our neutrality. And I think that must be that must be respected. And I think so there's many more things that we can do to avoid that. I think talking at this stage about our neutrality, I think, is not helpful.
Are you confusing non-belligerence with neutrality? Because what Irish people probably support is the fact that we don't go to war, we haven't colonised anywhere. But neutrality is something that the Swiss defend with a standing army of 120,000 people, the Finns defend with a standing army of, I think, 200,000 people.
No, I think to say that it misses that Ireland can be and always has been a voice for peace, justice and freedom throughout the world. So I think there's a very robust role for us to play there and to continue playing and to get to bring an end to this war and to play our part on the UN Security Council as well, rather than debating our neutrality at this particular time.
OK, Barry Anders, it's a fair point, isn't it, that the last thing that the world needs now is a militarily puny nation like Ireland aligning itself with NATO, that what the world probably needs is unaligned voices for peace that can conduct diplomacy outside of these usual routes.
Yes, I mean, alignment is very different to deployment. We can make those decisions without any alignment. I would never make an argument for joining NATO. I think NATO is guilty of adventurism over the last two decades that have resulted in massive loss of life, massive displacement of populations. And I don't think any interests are there. I think the interests are, as an EU member state, for the first time, there is a threat to fellow EU member states. Whether it is Estonia and Latvia that share a border with Russia, whether it is Finland that shares a border, these are non-aligned countries, by the way. Well, Estonia and Latvia are in NATO, but Finland is a non-aligned country. So what happens if there is an attack on Finland, which is also a non-aligned state? We're not confronting these realities. And if you're, as I said at the beginning, if your view hasn't changed, and if you fail to acknowledge that under the UN Charter, you're allowed to defend yourself, then that has implications for, but I think the starting point has to be the report on the Commission of the Defence Forces, which underlines how unfit for purpose our military are. And so for that reason, I would agree with Rose that we have a special role to play here, both through the UN Security Council and through our peacekeeping tradition and through our tradition for humanitarian support, which we've done exceptionally well over the last few days.
Philip, absolutely. We know that our services aren't fit for purpose, both our army, our navy, or the air force, and we need to make sure that that it's suitable for the geographical size and for our population. And that is, I think, where our concentrations should be as well, to make sure that we have forces that are fit for purpose.
Okay. Let's concentrate our attention a little bit more on sanctions. Oleg Deripaska is the owner of Okanish Alumina in Clare. The US Senate has said that his companies are proxies for the Kremlin. He denies this. The US Treasury has accused Deripaska of laundering money for Vladimir Putin. He denies this. A court case in 2012 heard allegations of mafia links and the murder of a business rival. Mr. Deripaska has also denied these claims. In Australia, where Mr. Deripaska also has considerable alumina investments, they sanctioned him this week. The UK, who have been notably slow to sanction some of Putin's cronies, has just sanctioned Deripaska this week. But the EU didn't place him on its most recent list of sanctioned individuals. Barry Anders, should Ireland?
He is already sanctioned by the US, as you say, and also by Australia and the UK now. He reduced his ownership, his beneficial ownership in Oganish to below 50%.
And the EU wrote to the US in 2020 and said that they believed that he was still functionally the beneficial owner, although he had reduced his day-to-day involvement.
What I would like to say, that as with all sanctions, we have to make sure that what we're doing is not just making a statement, but making an impact. And this plant is pretty important for global supply chains. And I think an argument has been made that we don't want to do more harm to ourselves than we do to the Russian regime, which is carrying out the war of aggression in Ukraine. We want to get that balance right, and that's a difficult balance.
This man is
Can I just make this final point? That if the decision is taken to sanction Mr. Deripaska, no Irish government minister will stand in the way of that at an EU level. And we have...
Are any actually lobbying for it, though?
Russia is the most sanctioned country in the world, more so than Syria, more so than North Korea. And, you know, Ireland has supported all of those sanctions and will continue to support any further sanctions that are taken, including
against
Mr. Dare's.
Has the Irish government actually lobbied for this?
That I don't know.
Because as I understand it, the reason that he hasn't been sanctioned is because of concerns in Malta and Cyprus. But I'm just wondering to...
I don't know the answer to that question, but I will say that I heard the Minister for Foreign Affairs very clearly state that if a decision is taken to sanction Mr. Deripaska, no Irish government minister will stand in the way of that.
Rose?
And we would certainly support that. And I think proper investigations need to be done. And we cannot be in a situation where we don't impose sanctions because we know that there are, I think it's 400 people employed. Yeah, there will be suffering and there's already suffering here because of what's happening in Ukraine. But certainly if that needs to be done, then we need to do it. We can't have a situation where funds from a company operating in Ireland is going to service the war.
Is there an inconsistency here, I wonder, Mick Barry, that on the one hand we say when it comes to the application of sanctions, we are going to move in lockstep with the European Union and do everything that they do. But when it comes to the issue of military support, we say, no, we're going to go our own way. Here, there's a clear case to be made for sanctioning Mr. Deripaska, is there not?
The 2 points I would make about sanctions, Philip. The first one is that the Irish political and business establishment have turned a blind eye for quite some time to the activities of Mr. Putin's supporters among the oligarchs in Russia. I mean, Fintan O'Toole in the Irish Times has pointed out that there was 112 billion euro worth of wealth went through Russian entities in the IFSC between 2005 and 2017. I don't know what Micheál Martin and Leo Varadkar thought that 112 billion was. Maybe it was communion money being stored up, etc., etc. So many questions to be asked there. But I would make a broader point, which is there's a presumption in the discussion that the thrust of these sanctions is positive in terms of bringing down the Putin regime. And I would just draw attention to the fact that, for example, it's been widely flagged McDonald's withdrawal from Russia. So McDonald's are gone. When McDonald's quit, that's 160,000 jobs of 160,000 Russian workers that were lost. Now, does that strengthen Putin or does it weaken Putin? Does it strengthen the anti-war movement in Russia, which is so important here, or does it actually serve to undermine it and allow the Putin regime to say, look, you know, the big Western companies, the United States, NATO, they're ganging up on us and you need to get behind the government and defend the country? I think on balance, what it is tending to do is to undermine the anti-war movement and to actually strengthen the Putin regime in some ways. And I come back to my previous example, and I finish on this point. There's been comparisons made to the activities of Putin and to the activities of the Tsar in the past. Well, the beginning of the end of World War One, and the end of the Tsar, and ultimately of capitalism in Russia, was protests and strikes on the streets of Russia by ordinary people. That is a point that is getting pushed to the side in that discussion, and measures that are taken have to weigh up, does this assist the movement to overthrow Putin and to build an anti-war movement, or does it harm it? And many of the sanctions are not positive in that sense.
Okay. Well, the far left characterised the Euromaidan uprising in Ukraine in 2014 as being motivated by the EU and being anti-democratic, and was criticised. And in fact, I think some left-wing groups in the Dáil voted against a resolution to criticise to support the Euromaidan uprising. So I don't know where Mick is getting this theory from.
Well, hang on a second. Is his point not that we tend to be a little bit cynical in this country about the possibility or the likelihood that internal dissent is going to ultimately be the thing that does for Vladimir Putin, that we tend to think of the Russians as being a homogenous political group who will do whatever their totalitarian dictator tells them?
But this is distraction from the far left. They're against sanctions, we've just heard from Mick. They're against any support of any nature to the Ukrainian armed forces. They want us to... I just think there's a towering naivety here about the change that occurred to European security on the 24th of February. And I think if you're coming to these arguments with the same inflexible ideology and history lessons from 1918 and the Tsar of Russia, I think you are displaying a willful political blindness to this issue.
OK. Fianna Fáil's Barry Andrews, also with me, People Before Profits, Mick Barry and Sinn Féin's Rose Conway-Walsh. Plenty more after this break. The Dubai-based parent company of P&O Ferries was reported to have calculated that it could halve its payroll costs by sacking 800 crew members and replacing them with agency staff. So, as you know, British-based staff were summarily sacked in a pre-recorded Zoom video, their replacements waiting on shore in buses to take over. Agency staff from the Philippines working elsewhere in P&O are reportedly paid as little as €2.16 an hour. There are serious ramifications here. P&O operates four sailings a day between Liverpool and Dublin and accounts for up to 10% of freight traffic through Dublin port. Any supply chain disruptions will only add further to cost of living increases, and Irish P&O employees must also be worried about what the company has in store for them. I'm joined by Mickey Smith from the UK Seafarers Union Nautilus. Good afternoon to you, Mickey. Are there still any sacked staff on any of the ships, or have they all been removed at this stage?
Yeah, good afternoon, Phil. Just to be pointed out there, please, that we're actually not a UK. We're UK, a vast majority of members are, but we have members throughout the world. We're one of the first international trade unions in the world, and we have various members, particularly in Ireland, of course.
And are any of those members still on ships now, Mickey, or have the security staff taken off?
All our members, well, what's happened here, Phil, all our members were summarily dismissed and were forced off physically by security guards on St. Patrick's Day. Absolutely outrageous. All those employees, permanent employed employees from Jersey contracts, were summarily dismissed and forced off the vessels. So the only people who remain on board the vessels now are those that was brought in as agency staff and those Filipino seafarers that obviously are on the North Bay and the North Bank.
And is it the case that they might also be paid as little as $2.16 an hour?
Well, I believe that the figures I've seen, they were paid slightly higher than that, Phil. I believe they've been paid between $5.50 an hour. That's what I've seen for the Filipino seafarers. Okay. And by the way, the Filipino seafarers have been on board that them vessels for God knows, because I actually worked on that vessel myself in Norway for circa 3 years. I was second officer on it before I joined the union full time 8 years ago, because they actually did work for P&O for 27 years.
From your point of view, Mickey, in Nautilus, to what extent is this episode a rerun of the Irish Ferries dispute from 2005?
Phil, you just took the words right out of my mouth there, my friend, and that's what it is. It's just a rerun, disgraceful behaviour by an unscrupulous employer. And it's just, you know, it's just like going back in time. It's outrageous. It was actually like a military operation. The fact is, eight ships were simultaneously stopped, told to discharge their passengers, discharge the cargo, delay alongside. Three vessels in Dover. We had obviously the North Bay, and shot, and all these vessels just laid up simultaneously, and we had an announcement. An announcement was, you're summarily dismissed by video link. By Mr. Good.
And do you think that it's
Mr.
the
Good,
case...
I actually spoke to Mr. Good, the guy who delivered that. He's just been... he's only been introduced to the company for possibly about 6 weeks ago. And I worked with this guy previously about 7 years ago in an oil ferry company. And I had a meeting with him circa 10 days ago. And as God is my judge, he says, Mickey, it's great to work with you again. We hope to work in partnership and cooperation as Nautilus do as a union for maritime professionals. And I says, yes, looking forward to working with you, Andy. And there we go. The next time I seen him, he was on the screen dismissing our members. Mm. Somebody dismissing 800 seafarers. Disgusting.
Not much sign of partnership there, no, indeed. And I wonder, do you think that it is their calculation that if there are fines for potentially flouting labour laws here, that it is still worth their while to pay those fines, to pay 12 weeks redundancy, because they still get to halve their payroll costs?
This is what they're up to. It's just, honest to goodness, this didn't happen overnight, Phil. This obviously took months of preparation to get seafarers, because there is a shortage of seafarers throughout the world, and it's not been helped by the terrible atrocity that's occurring in Ukraine. and how they got these seafarers to Dublin and to Larne and elsewhere, Liverpool and Hull and Dover, of course. It's unbelievable. It took a lot of work. And this agency that's been set up, International Ferry Management, was only set up last month. As I say, they've been planning this for a long, long time.
Okay. What should the Irish government do?
Irish government should be speaking directly to P&O Ferries, and they should be intervening, as we've requested the British shipping minister to intervene. We've got a meeting coming up with the First Minister of Scotland. We've obviously made representations up in Stormont that they should get involved and speak to P&O directly, because I never thought that they had agreed with Sammy Wilson, the local MP for Larne, who called it Dickensian practices. But the fact of the matter is that Mr. Hathaway, who is the chief executive of P&O Ferries, who's only been in the company for a few years now, and he gives Sammy Wilson assurances regarding safety. He also gave Nicola Sturgeon, the First Minister of Scotland, safety assurances. Well, I'll be speaking to Nicola Sturgeon next week. I've spoken on several occasions, but I'll be emphasising that I would take a pinch of salt what Mr. Hathaway says, because I'll give him a word, Phil. I had a meeting with Mr. Hathaway a couple of years, 2 years ago, bad teams when we're going through redundancy exercises, which obviously they cut too deep because we're looking right at the Jersey contracts. And he says to me, would I kindly stop using nautical terms and abbreviations, because he didn't know what I was talking about.
Okay.
So that's the same guys giving assurances to ministers and MPs and God knows who else, and TDs, no doubt.
All right.
And he wouldn't know what safety was if he'd seen it spelled backwards.
Mickey Smith of Nautilus, thank you very much for talking to us this afternoon. Barry Andrews, what should, what can the government do here? Or does self-interest dictate on this occasion that we get these supply routes across the Irish Sea back up and running again as quickly as possible, no matter who is crewing these ships?
No, I mean, I'd agree with Mickey. You can hear the anger and frustration in his voice. I, he's not putting that on. That's really genuine. And the British government, I think what we shouldn't do is write to the wrong chairman of P&O, which is what the British government did, the chairman who resigned and who stepped down back in December. I think it falls more within the British government's remit. There is some confusion about applicable law here, which underlines the need to strengthen the law if there is a continuing confusion about which law applies. I think there are Brexit elements to this, the lack of use of the land bridge by Irish hauliers since the end of the transition period is having an impact on P&O's bottom line. And we have diversified our supply chains across the directly.
But
France.
The real bottom line here seems to be that back in 2019, DP World paid an exorbitant price for this company. They've realised now with a reduced business that they just can't afford it, and that a crude and cruel measure like this was their only way back to profitability.
Exactly, and I think that I think they've crossed the line here in a very, very cynical way, and I don't think they're going to get away with it. There are questions of criminal prosecution of directors.
I know, but yet you're saying that we should leave it up to the British government?
Well, I mean, you know, I don't think the Irish government is going to be behind the door if there's anything that we can do to support the workers in these circumstances. Okay. I'm not privy to what decisions have been taken about how we're going to support the workers in these circumstances, but I completely agree that this is Dickensian. It's 101 in redundancy. You have to have consultation if you have large-scale redundancies. And this didn't happen in this case. And there are major questions now about the adequacy of the pension scheme for the workers. So there may well be criminal prosecutions. And this goes to not just the reputation of this company, but also to its viability within the UK.
Rose Conway-Walsh?
Yeah, it's absolutely disgraceful and callous. And I think anybody watching the video clip of people being given their redundancy notices, 800 people over video link, I think was absolutely one of the cruelest things that I've ever seen.
We're all agreed and on that, but how do we respond?
Okay,
is there anything that we can do?
Okay, there's a couple of things. But first, when you say about the financial viability, we have to remember that P&O were given 150 million as part of COVID payments. Then they paid out 250 million in dividends over that time. Certainly, the Irish government need to engage urgently, and they must explore all options, and that includes taking over the ferries operations.
You would nationalise P&O, would you?
If that's what needs to be done, I really, honestly, this is really, really serious. not only for in terms of P&O, but in terms of other companies looking at that. We cannot stand over in any way. We cannot stand over something like this happening and people being treated in this callous manner.
Are you floating the suggestion of nationalisation, or is that Sinn Féin's considered position?
No, I am saying that. I'm saying every option must be explored, and that includes the taking over of the ferry operations. That could be done through the shared island unit. I think it really has to be looked at, Philip. You know, it has to be explored by government, and I think government need to be proactive in this. We cannot just sit in our hands and see what will happen. I have never seen anything like this. I have never seen workers treated in the way that they have been here. And as you said, we've been replaced with workers getting paid $2.50 an hour. We cannot stand over that.
Mick Barry?
Yeah, I would place no faith in either the British government or the Irish government to resolve this issue. I think we saw here in this state last year, the year before, 1,000 workers, overwhelmingly women in Debenhams, being sacked by way of an email, very similar story. And not only did Micheál Martin and Leo Varadkar not lift a finger to help them, they also, you know, sat quietly by when more than 300 Gardaí were mobilised in order to break their picket lines, which reminded me, I was reminded of that when I saw the private security dressed like robocops going onto the ships here and escorting workers who had 3 decades of service off the ships, you know, dangling handcuffs and all the rest of it. I think it's not just one of several options. I think that what should be done here is the nationalisation of what's an important service and the defence of the jobs. And I think that huge pressure needs to be brought by the workers' movement on the governments, both in Britain and in Ireland, in that respect.
Barry Andrews, has Mick Barry got a point here? Because the only official response that I have seen from government has come from the Department of Transport, who just noted that there was not going to be major disruption to Irish Sea ferry sailings. Nothing about the workers, nothing in support of them, no talk of negotiations or consultation with P&O at all.
Yeah, I think there will be a response from government. I'm not fully aware of what decisions have been taken at government level, but I think
so. You're here as a government spokesperson today.
Well, yeah, I that look. But I mean, the point is that we do have to support these workers. The way they've been treated is absolutely appalling. I know that in the north, for example, there's going to be a committee hearing in the assembly to deal, you know, to look at the questions, to try to establish some of the facts, not all of which we are completely seized of at the moment.
I note you're not responding to the suggestion that P&O could be nationalised.
I don't think that is an option. I really don't think we should be looking at nationalisation. I think we need to look at all of the tools that are available to us and the tools that are available to the UK government to carry out criminal prosecutions of directors that have you know, made decisions that are completely flouting redundancy legislation. And I think it's important to point out that workers that are contracted under French or Dutch contracts were not targeted by this redundancy announcement. And it underlines the fact that Brexit itself is undermined workers' rights in a tremendous way in the UK. And that's why UK contracts were targeted. And it, you know, it may be Jersey contracts.
Well, they weren't UK contracts, they were Jersey contracts, which seems to be what
there is. But this is the point I made at the beginning. There is some question about which law applies. It does underline the fact that we need to strengthen the legal, the UK needs to strengthen the legal basis for the way in which workers are employed. And I think it really underlines that the ideology of Brexit is a disaster. And it really strikes me as I don't understand why the far left, for example, supported Brexit when it has had this disastrous effect on workers' rights. And we know that a lot of the workers' rights we have in this country and in the EU have come from EU decisions, directives and regulations over the years.
All right. Mick Barry, the last thing that this country can afford to see at the moment in terms of the cost of living increases that are going on in the background on a daily basis is any further disruption to supply chains. So isn't the realpolitik of this that we need the P&O ferry sailings up and running again as soon as possible?
We do need the P&O ferries, so that's an argument in favour of the nationalisation of P&O in order to protect the service.
And you think that that's not going to be disputed through the courts?
What's that?
You think that that's not going to be disputed through the courts?
I'm sure it will be disputed by the through the courts, but governments have powers too, and that's the solution to this that that I would argue for. Yes, so that's my position.
Okay, look, everything that we've been talking about here adds to this pylon of pressure on the domestic economy. On Wednesday, the Federal Reserve in the United States increased interest rates and indicated that there would be up to 6 increases this year. A European Central Bank member said today that rate increases here later this year are realistic. So their analysis is that inflation is not going down anytime soon. In the last 12 months, bread has increased 8%, pasta by 6%, sugar by 5%, all of which is naturally adding up. Wayne Stanley, Simon Community National Spokesperson, joins us now. Wayne, you're seeing more and more people, I gather, looking for help in the last week of the month when money has run out before payday.
Yeah, thanks for having us on, Philip. I suppose the Simon communities, as you know, the majority of people who are coming to us are generally in housing difficulty. So it's unusual for our food services. We use those predominantly as mechanisms for people who are in homelessness as a way to engage and to draw them into our services, to provide support as an additional support. A phenomenon that's been happening over the last couple of months has been exactly that, where people who are not, who are in accommodation, are presenting to our services for the last week or 2 weeks of the month when essentially money has run out. And it's exactly for the reasons you've just outlined, is between unaffordable rents and increasing household costs, they just don't have any money towards the end of the month.
And you're seeing a rise in single women looking for assistance. Do you understand why?
We're seeing an increase in the number of single women. We've also seen, and this is well documented, a big increase in the number of young people in homelessness. A characteristic that both of those groups sort of generally held hold within homelessness is that often they experience what we call hidden homelessness. So that they're more likely to have places where they can sleep on a couch or sort of keep themselves out of emergency accommodation. But both of those groups seem to be presenting more and more. And indeed, like we've seen a very significant increase in the number of 18 to 24-year-olds in homelessness. I think nationally it's increased by over 300 young people year on year. 350, in fact, about a 46% increase. So what that says to us is there's less and less sort of social capacity there where people would have sort of kept people out of homelessness. And that seems to be predominantly, or certainly the cost of living aspect of it, it does seem to be a push factor in it. It's also, of course, at the end of the day, homelessness is about the cost of accommodation and the availability of affordable accommodation. And okay, as we know, rents are just exorbitant.
Please don't infer in this question any suggestion on my part that we shouldn't take in refugees from Ukraine. But what do you see happening to that pressure on housing over the course of the next few weeks now, given that there are 8,000 here and could be as many as 22,000 by the end of the month?
I think you're right. I think we shouldn't draw a comparator. I think there are two very distinct issues. One is a huge number of people who have been displaced by a war. Ireland is part of the European response. I'm talking to colleagues across Europe in Greece and in colleagues who are obviously at the front line of this in Poland. So we all need to play our part. And I think the Irish government is doing a good job in this role. I think the immediate response is the provision of shelter, and that's why you see the Department of Children and Equality going out and acquiring hotels and spaces. So that's the initial response of it. I think the longer term impact, and you know, if we're talking about 100,000 people coming here and having to stay long term, there will be possibly increased pressure on the housing system that we're going to have to be addressed. But at the moment, sort of thinking that through is really to engage in speculation, because we don't know how long the war is going to go on. We don't know how many people are going to have to stay.
So I
think at the moment, for me, and I think for us, it's broadly speaking two distinct avenues, and we have to keep up with the work of addressing homelessness. So there are things we can continue to do, like the government is committed to bringing into legislation the Simon Bill, which creates more capacity for local authorities and organisations like Simon to prevent people from having to cross the threshold of a homeless service. So we need to keep up that work while continuing to support people coming from Ukraine.
OK, Wayne Stanley, the Simon community, thank you very much. Rose, let me pick up on a point that he made there at the beginning. It's not just about rising rents. It is about rising fuel costs. As these people who are presenting to the Simon community are saying, it's about rising food costs. It's the whole basket of increases here. So would you agree that that and this conversation that we have been having today shows that so much of the cost of living increases are outside of the government's control?
Yes, they are. A lot of them are outside the government control, but how the government responds is really important. And that's why we, on home heating oil, for instance, we pleaded with the government to take the excise off that, which would mean just for oil heating alone that you take €100 off a fill of oil for people. I don't think the government are going far enough. I think what they did was certainly welcome, and we supported that in the Dáil, but we know that they could have gone much further in terms of fuel. And that particularly mitigates against people in rural Ireland, because we know 2/3 of people are dependent on home oil in rural Ireland, but also in terms of journeys that have to be made, whether they are journeys to hospitals and to other appointments. We certainly need to have cars in rural Ireland, and it's mitigating against them. But it's a combination of things. We've also seen with the rents, if we look even at, you know, a place like Castlebar at the moment, where you didn't have housing problems before, now you have renters there being charged maybe 1/3 of what they were paying a few months ago. So that's all accumulating into a situation where people are really, really struggling and really, really juggling between how to keep their heads
above water. Barry Andrews, do you want to reply briefly to that?
Well, first of all, I just want to commend Wayne Stanley from the Simon community for refusing to be drawn into conflating the Ukrainian refugee issue with the homeless issue. I think that was very principled of him. Secondly, I agree with Rose that the government won't be blamed for matters that are outside of their control. And of course, Ukraine is one of them. But it will be blamed if it doesn't respond appropriately. And the cost of living issue has been addressed by the Irish government to an extent. It's like trying to catch a falling knife, because it's a very dynamic situation. And I think that we're going to have to take more steps. The government has said they're not going to do anything between now and October. I'm not sure how sustainable that's going to be. But I think that we have to, you know, within the homeless issue is obviously been exacerbated. It sort of paused a little bit during the pandemic. I think there was a recognition that the most vulnerable people, the homeless people in Ireland, were well looked after during the pandemic. There has been a spike since then. Minister Dara O'Brien set up a homeless action committee. The cabinet set up that homeless action committee chaired by Dara O'Brien at the end of last year. And there are specific targets in housing for all. So we have a plan. We recognise there is a spike, and it has now been exacerbated by the circumstances that have just been outlined.
Mick Barry, does the brutal way in which petrostates like Russia, like Saudi Arabia now, are levering their advantage over us, does it make the case in your mind for accelerating the decarbonisation of the Irish economy? Or would you have us put a stay on carbon tax hikes coming in May and October?
I think what it clearly points to is moving away from a reliance on fossil fuels that are owned and controlled by regimes such as the ones that you mentioned. And I think it makes the case very strongly as to why we need to have a big, big increase in investment. And I think that means state-led investment in green energy and in renewables. Okay. I would make the point in relation to Wayne's comment there about single women and young people, that obviously it's the people who are incomes who are hit the hardest. The SIP2 economist Michael Taft has made the point that 5.6% inflation for society equals 8.5% inflation for those paid to pay proportionate amount of their incomes on essentials. And I think this points powerfully towards two things. First of all, the need for a major increase in the national minimum wage. I would argue €15 an hour. The government have increased the minimum wage by less than the rate.
Mick, I'm not going to interrupt you because I'm disagreeing with you, but because I can't hear you, and unfortunately the quality of that line is degenerating. So what we might do is try and sort it out over a quick ad break. Okay, quite literally in the last minute of the programme that's left to us, I want to mark the fact that this is the COVID Remembrance Weekend, but I want to do so by talking to the General Secretary of the Irish Nurses and Midwives Organisation, Phil Nie. A bittersweet occasion, I would imagine, Phil.
Indeed. I think it's fair to say that COVID is very much a real feature of everyday working lives of nurses, midwives and other healthcare professionals, including this weekend. We see very busy hospitals and we're a bit nervous about next week because usually after a bank holiday, the attendance numbers go up. We've had a double bank holiday, so undoubtedly next week is going to be extraordinarily busy.
And you still haven't got your €1,000 bonus?
No, we haven't. And we're meeting the HSC again on Monday because they're now introducing caveats to it. We've asked our members to lobby politicians over this weekend to see if somebody can bring a bit of sense to this. You know, €1,000 doesn't sound like a lot. It was welcomed when it was announced, but seeking to introduce measures that would reduce it, it just seems to make absolutely no sense and misses the point, misses the mark, and is leaving a very bad taste in the mouths of those who have actually done extraordinary work over the last 2 years.
A succinctly made point, and thank you for doing so in the short amount of time that we had left to us on the programme. My thanks also to Rose Conway Walsh, to Barry Andrews and to Mick Barry. The programme was produced by Penny Hart Research by Andrew Fleming. Katie will be back with you next week. Saturday Sport coming up.